The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
You're very welcome, Max. So we are talking about Ireland's Grand Slam. 1948, 2009 and now 2018 are very much added to, what's still an exclusive list in Irish rugby. We have Brian O'Driscoll here in the studio. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
What was with all that drama in 2009? I mean,
what's the stress all about?
What an odd way, in a brilliant way, to win a Grand Slam from an Irish point of view, where it feels like it just should be last gasp and blood and thunder and falling over the line.
The excitement was a strange one. Like, obviously we were delighted, but there's no nervous excitement, certainly not for me up in studio sitting between Clive Woodward and Johnny Wilkinson. It felt from pretty early on that there was an air of an inevitability to Ireland winning this game.
Almost as early as halftime.
It was a matter of how much are we going to win this game by? And that's not being arrogant. That is literally just of how the flow of the game went. For a number of reasons, I think I was very disappointed with the England that came out.
Anything in particular?
The first 10 minutes, I just, like, you have to have this hateful intent to right the wrongs of the two previous weeks, of people starting to sharpen their knives, say that you're not the team you were 12 months ago. A reaction because you're back at home, you haven't lost there for 14 matches, and yet people are talking of the Irish coming to town and, you know, potentially, you know, putting you to the sword. So all of that would have served for me as a huge carrot to come and really bring a ferocity to the first 10 minutes, where the Irish would have been stunned and thought, gosh, we are really in for a test match here. And I just didn't see it. And if anything, I thought we imposed ourselves on the game very early on and looked like the aggressor of the two.
Yeah, that was very strange. Interestingly, Clive Woodward, who you were in the ITV studio with, he may have said on the coverage, or it may have been in his article somewhere afterwards, but he looked at England and said that they looked tired. He mentioned the lines, then the club demands, and then Eddie Jones seems to be training them incredibly hard. He said, "We haven't been firing any shots over these last three games. The team are out on their feet." Now, I don't know, it was a tiredness, but I think a lot of people were struck by the fact that, as were you, that in that first 10 minutes, there was no blood and thunder and we're just going to tear into you. Maybe it's tiredness, maybe it's something else, but it definitely was striking.
Maybe it's lack of confidence, but you don't need confidence to bring that. That's the thing. It's the first thing. It's intent is either in you or it's not. Mm. And I think that was the most disappointing aspect. I think England got parts of their game plan together towards the end of the game when it was all but over. But that's one of the frustrations. If I was in the England camp and I was an English supporter looking at them, I'd be thinking, you know, where was our bluster early on? Where was our right, our statement of intent that this is going to be an 80 minute of a dogged performance, and irrespective of our skill set and attack shape and everything that went to that, just at rook time, let's be ruthless.
An emotional performance almost.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And that's a state of mind. Emotional is a state of mind. But I said in advance of the game, in my punditry with ITV, I did feel it was a case of anger versus accuracy.
Yeah.
And we got the accuracy for sure. We didn't get a whole lot of anger.
Yeah. Okay. It was the best performance of the championship from an Irish point of view is how it's been talked about?
I think so. That first half performance, you know, besides the three tries, besides the taking of their opportunities, I think they left a few out there as well. The dogged defence, both at Mull, right on our own line, the scramble, kick game, again, very good. I watched the game a second time today and I found myself, I said, I better take some notes on this. Mm-hmm. And I wrote most of the notes that I was to make in the first 10 or 15 minutes because I was so impressed. Like, Murray's box kicking, it is so important.
It was
to
the
us.
One in the first or second minute where he had no right to kick it as far as he did.
It was 40 metres. It was 40 metres from the 5 metre.
Against a bit of a wind.
I actually don't really know how he does that. Yeah. Obviously, he practices a hell of a lot, but it's the consistency of that.
Was the wind strong in the stadium?
We were in the box, so we didn't.
There was definitely a bit of a wind.
It's ITV, not BBC, where they're all freezing outside. Yeah. No, there was a wind, and it was hard to really know. The commentary were saying it was swirling, but there was no sense of one direction or another.
Yeah.
But it's that. It's that relieving pressure. I was sitting beside Johnny Wilkinson. He was saying what a dream that must be for Johnny Sexton to play with Conor Murray, where he relieves that pressure time and time again and gets much further than Johnny would if you're passing the ball back 10 yards to make sure it doesn't get blocked down. And then they have to, under pressure of a couple of a scrum half and some flankers coming at them, have an accurate kick. It's unlikely that you're going to get it as far as Conor Murray is doing.
And extraordinary.
That is, it's such a lovely sight for, for a backline, but for a pack to look up and see that they don't have a line out 10 yards from where they are, that it's 30, 40 yards up the pitch. And it just relieves the stress and the pressure that's been exerted on you.
What else did you jot down in that first
Dan Levy's tackle count and ball carrying.
He's in every screenshot ever. You can't find a picture where the ball is there and he's not within 10 metres.
His energy to the very end was absolutely brilliant. And it was almost in unison with James Ryan. The collisions seemed to be side by side so often. But his ball carrying, his footwork laid at the line, because everyone knows Sean O'Brien, who's the usual wearer of the number 7 jersey, may be intermittently with Josh van der Fleer in advance of this Six Nations. Both of them have very good footwork at the line. Dan Levy's footwork is as good as theirs, if not better. Manages to get himself out of big collisions where you think he's going to have to take a shot for the team now, but gets a soft shoulder, carries for another 2 yards. Is those momentum builders actually give you the front football versus defensive lines really getting off the mark. So
it seems to be, you tell me either way, he seems to be good on the ground and pop up from the bottom of a ruck as well.
He is forming himself into the Dream 7,
right,
because he does a bit of everything. He's carrying, but he's getting through an awful lot of dirty work. I think Stander is a huge ball carrier for us, and Peter gets through an awful lot of the grind too. But I think Dan probably marries the two. He's not afraid to carry, but he's also muddying the opposition's ball. He's first man to clear out the ruck, made some brilliant collisions. As first impact, winning the shoulder, making sure that they didn't lock on, slowing our ruck ball down. Those were a couple of things. And as the game grew on, I thought defence of Keith Earls was magnificent. He has had the best tournament I've seen him play. In conjunction with Rob Kearney, I think he's probably had his best ever Six Nations. Standards ball carrying, was it 20 plus carries, and some of it was just for 2 yards, but it was to allow for others to regroup. It's not always to get an advantage line, it's to buy time. And there's an art form in that little dip and collision win, even though there's a likelihood he might only get half a yard or a yard, or maybe it might be a neutral collision. It's just to allow the rest of the team to regenerate, to get their shape back. Yeah. And he is the best at doing that.
If you're making those notes in that first 20 minutes, then those notes will also feature two Irish tries, both of which you feel were pre-prepared and ready to go. The Watson was going to be targeted under a high ball, and then everybody's expecting the loop to go to Johnny, and they're all watching Johnny. And Matt Williams was making the point on TV3. He was saying that, that loop move originated way back when in Australia, and Eddie Jones knows it, and Joe Schmidt knows it very well. And Eddie knows that Joe knows, and Joe knows that Eddie knows, and Eddie knows that Joe knows that Eddie knows. And so, Jones was set up to defend it, and he rope-a-doped him.
He absolutely did.
Yeah.
Let's go back first and cover the ring rose try, because it was the opportunity was handed to us with the late charge from Farrell, penalty up, where the ball landed up by the Ireland 40, kicked into the corner, played one phase, and then went to the air.
Yeah.
Again, I think defensively questionable in the air. He has been. He's very exciting going forward, but Watson is not assured in that area of his game yet. And so we went right after it early on, which was a brilliant play and a great contestable. Rob didn't have the opportunity of quite getting a good catch to it, but he was there to disrupt. I absolutely think he knocked it on, personally.
I
did. Johnny Wilkinson called it immediately in real time. I thought I agreed with him.
Yeah.
And then some of the angles that the TMO showed were like, I think that's a knock on there, but he just brushed over it very, very quickly.
They went very quickly to let's look at the grounding.
It was the palm of his hand, and it clearly impacts that forward, and you need your luck in winning Grand Slams, and we got some against France by getting an opportunity in the final few minutes with a bad miss penalty from them. But you ride your luck too, and great follow up from Gary Ringrose. But I do think the TMO got that wrong.
Yeah,
we'll take it.
Yeah.
The second one was rope-a-dope. Absolutely. I hope that's your, they're your words, not mine. And before I get quoted on them,
Brian O'Driscoll, Joe rope-a-doped Eddie. Great.
The loop play isn't as simplistic as everyone makes. There's lots of different varieties. There's the inside loop where it's a simple wraparound. There's also what's known as the Brumbies play, where the first man hits the second guy, and then there's a short runner outside him, and then it goes between the two. So there are. It's not maybe just Ireland do the loop play or Leinster do the loop play. There's a bit more to it. This was very, very clever though, because of the personnel there, because we had Stander running the short line to sit them inside, because Levy also, it was actually a tunnel ball between the two of them to Johnny Sexton to sit the inside defence. Yeah, ball. So in front of Levy, behind Stander, tunnel through to Johnny, who then shifted on really early. And that's the secret on this particular loop play. On a lot of other loop plays, he'll try and straighten early, sit the defence down and then throw the pass and then come on the loop if he wants to get it back. But he threw this one really early.
Okay.
As if...
So what does that tell the defence?
He just sold it. It's okay. Like, it's a very small modification to the way he does it. But he threw the pass laterally, and which is something that he doesn't very often do.
And sorry to interrupt, what message is that giving the defence then?
It spells that he's doing the loop play early.
Okay.
Right? So sometimes, by hitting it straight and then throwing the pass and coming on the loop, you don't know exactly what it is. By him throwing that pass early and getting on his bike, you know immediately that the loop play is about to happen.
He tried to make it very obvious to them.
Correct.
I'm Johnny here and I'm doing the loop play, everyone.
This is the loop play that you've seen so often. So, you know, how are you going to defend it? I'm going to get it back now in a second.
Yeah.
So how are you going to defend it? You're going to follow me around the corner, as Owen Farrell did. Mm. He actually gets excited, realizing that
the loop play
is coming. He's like, I'm going to get him.
Okay.
Because when we played against Argentina years ago, when we used to do it with Ron O'Gara, Felipe Contepomi used to do that at 10. He used to always chase Rog around and try and get to him. You sometimes break the integrity of the line, because if someone steps back in, there's no hustle to chase there, but it's a risk that sometimes he was willing to take, and he had some success. Mm. So Farrell obviously saw that. They've been on Lions tour together. He likes the loop play. This is the loop play. and then the brilliance, Stockdale's out the back showing intent that they're going to go wide. You've got to have animation there. That's really important. And then you've got Tadhg Furlong, who's a tight head prop. He's not going to have anything too flashy of it, skill wise. So you don't have Gary Ringrose in there. You've got Tadhg Furlong, so it must be just a bog standard loop play. Yeah. And then you've Bundiaki outside him, who's kind of nonchalantly running up and looks a little bit disinterested that maybe he's gotten his timing wrong. And then you have this beautiful pivot pass from Tadhg Furlong as Johnny is coming around, and the timing of it all happening. Johnny's just about to come around the back and Bundy's just a fraction in front of him. You've got Farrell chasing
Johnny.
You've got Ben Teo about to read in and kill Johnny on the other side. He's like, the loop play's coming.
Yeah.
And then the little slip play, as it's known. And then Bundy through Gary Ringrose flooding there immediately, obviously thinking that's where they might have thought what the obvious try was, but credit to Watson, he got back and covered Ringrose. Johnny May got to Bundiaki, but that skill to throw that pass to Stander, who then made himself available after running that decoy, was a magnificent piece of skill from Bundiaki.
His passing can be criticised.
Well, yeah, it can be. I don't think there's a whole lot wrong with it, but it was the quality of pass, but the reaction time of him realizing that Gary wasn't on, to look and know, you know, maybe got good communication from Stander. You can't really see how much he shouted at him, but it's as if he looked to his right, it wasn't on for Gary, looked to his left, saw it, and threw it immediately as he saw it. And then Stander's carry and the cleverness of running, of getting to the post too. He knew what he was doing there. He didn't, obviously, he was trying to run away from Wigglesworth, but maybe subconsciously he was thinking, let's get close to the post. If I don't, worst case scenario, if I don't get there, at least we have the post to play with on the pick and jam thereafter. So the sequence of everyone doing their role there was an absolute thing of joy.
Wow. I mean, when you break it down like that, it's fantastic. Even the small thing of Stockdale out the back as if to say, Johnny's getting the loop and he's coming to me, to let Ben Teo know you definitely want to hit Johnny.
Yeah, because you just need to keep, you've got to keep everyone interested out there. Yeah, yeah. And it's that's the expectation of you as an outside back when you're not getting it. It's almost, I don't know, and I've used this before in acting parlance, I hear from my wife saying, it's, you know, when a shot is not on you, when it's, you know, when you're, you know, you're out of the picture, to still give the same energy and effort to the scene to make sure that other people perform really well. That's the exact same as a backline play, of being able to show that animation. It's the selflessness of running as hard as you would if you were getting the ball when you're not going to get it.
Amazing. And such a thrilling result. Like, there's that moment, I think everybody, particularly probably watching TV, kind of goes, whoa, you know, you cut through. And then, I mean, the players' reaction, they enjoy every try, but there was a real element of nailed that.
Yeah. And as the years go on, there's more plays that I've never seen. I've seen lots of them over the course of the last 4 years.
Would you say the game has passed you by, Brian?
But it is, and when we were doing the outside broadcast with Martin Johnson during the week, I did say that I'm really looking forward to seeing what Rabbit Joe Schmidt pulls out of his hat and what he has up his sleeve, because he always will personalise a play to suit the opposition or the personnel of that opposition.
That's very interesting, because I did wonder at times with Schmidt and with, I suppose, any coach, is there just a certain amount of plays in your creativity book? Does the well just run dry and you're like, do you know what, I can't think of any coaches,
100%. Right. You just see the same ones coming up. And if you see someone over the course of a 15-year career that might be in five or six different clubs or with a couple of countries thrown in there, if they're lucky enough to have done that, you see the same plays. It's rare enough that you see the modifications like we're seeing with this Ireland team. I think there's ingenuity like you would associate with other great teams like the All Blacks. I think we are at the cutting edge, and Joe Schmidt is at the cutting edge of plays. And in years to come, we're going to see other coaches copying what he is doing, because his thought given to the game plan and the rationale behind it, I think, differentiates him from any other coach in the world.
And away from just those plays in the Joe versus Eddie battle, Is it more than just the scoreboard, or did Joe just clearly come out on top?
I think he definitely came out on top. I was really disappointed with England's game plan in that, where were we vulnerable for the whole tour? We were vulnerable out wide. And what do you have to do to get teams out wide? You've got to exhaust the extremities. I thought what they did far too much. They rarely went down. They'd hit to the midfield and they might get to the 15-yard line. And then an awful lot of the time, they'd hit back into the midfield again. Ireland, you've got to work defences around the corner. That's how you get people to tire. That's how you make them offer the extra exertion. And that all adds up for later on in the game. And I just didn't think they tried to exhaust Ireland enough and stretch us where we had been vulnerable in the past.
Yeah.
To try and narrow Ireland up and then get out to that 15-metre channel. I saw none of that. And that's what disappointed me about their tactics. They had a bit of success towards the end of the game, but it was over as a contest at that stage.
Yeah.
When George Ford came on, they got a bit of front football as well. I think the ruck was always going to be a massive component. We won that again. And that's where the anger and the brutality is a frustration to me, because rucking is a state of mind. Yes, it's a technique aspect, but it's also a state of mind of sheer force over technique will work every day of the week.
Yeah.
And they just didn't really appear to have that. And And Ireland were a bit more clinical. We slowed ball down. Our accuracy of pinning the right and left-hand side of the ruck, you know, the third man to clean up. Sometimes you might only need to clear a ruck with one man. And then, you know, whoever's first in plays half back. You need, I saw Cian Healy throwing a pass in our own 22, like you would see from Conor Murray. Yeah. It was a thing. I don't remember that. That wasn't the case 4 years ago. His skill set has improved. Everyone's ability to pass was very, very evident. And conversely, I think England's quality of passing was very, very poor, particularly in the back line. Save for George Ford and Farrell, I thought everyone else stuck inside shoulders. Any time that England had an opportunity to stretch us, the pass went inside shoulder.
Okay, that's a worry. Jacob Stockdale had a literally a historic season, 7 tries in the Six Nations. No one's ever managed that. He's still only 21. There is, I mean, it's not even, you're not even downplaying him to say this is a dream season. Like, nobody can replicate this year after year after year after year. So my question to you is, how good is Jacob Stockdale when he falls back from whatever this weird freak of nature high is to his kind of average standard level that we'll get from him for the next 10 years?
He looks pretty good, doesn't he? It's you know what? He's had a dream season. Not well. He'll say, is it unsustainable? Yeah. Listen, 7 tries in the Six Nations is, you know, it's never been done before. Yeah. So, you know, you'd have to imagine the players will mark him a little bit more fervently next year and give a bit more focus to him. Do a little bit more individual analysis on him. Second season is always that little bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. And the more you are known, the more difficult it does tend to get. But then the top class players are able to see their way through that and discover new parts to their game and, you know, present one picture and then deliver something else. But going forward in particular, he has been exceptional. He's made not only his tries, his finishing's been very good. He hasn't had that many walk-ins. He's obviously had a couple of intercepts, but he's had to read them well. And it, you know, the try and finish at the weekend was a footballing finish. But you know, can we expect him to score 7 tries in next year's Six Nations? Probably not. But he looks as though he has even when he wasn't scoring tries, his small touches, the Conor Murray try against Italy, where he gave Jack Conan the pass, the way he drew the defender infield to create a little bit of space in a 2 meter channel. They're small little aspects that maybe go a little bit unnoticed, but that's a footballer. That's someone that has real rugby intellect, being able to create those opportunities for others. So I think that's, for me, what has been very evident, besides the try scoring and finishing capabilities. I think he is a very young lad, and I've always said that the last part to most young players' game is their defence, and he will definitely improve on that in time. We saw him fall off a couple of tackles throughout the Six Nations and, you know, make it the odd read, but, you know, I was saying in here a couple of weeks ago, I made some terrible reads when I was 30 years of age too. So we won't shoot him for that, but it'll come. But he definitely looks as though he's the real deal. And the big question will be, can he stay fit? And can he continue to improve with that extra scrutiny that comes when now he's become a mainstay in the Irish setup, and that he will definitely get an awful lot more focus when people are analysing Ireland.
Yeah, remarkable first season. I presume that applies for Larmour in defence as well, which makes Gary Ringrose kind of just weird. I mean, even you can really appreciate it when you're there, and he came in for the Scotland game, and it's like he just exudes this kind of intelligence, calmness.
Yeah, he's miles older though. He's 23.
Like the intelligence to like almost sacrifice a few yards to the opposition at the right time, and suddenly the onus is back on them, and the Irish defence is back in control. He seems to, but he will shoot up as well at times.
But that's good defending, right? That's understanding, being able to read your situation, understanding where you're a little bit stretched, where you've got a good plug from the inside, where you've got nice shape. And a big aspect is when you're numbered up is don't continue drifting. You need to call the hit call where you're just, where everyone knows your man on. And I think Gary brings a different level of intelligence than we've had previously at 13 over the course of the last 15 years. He is really a very, very smart player, obviously very talented going forward, but his defensive nous is a real asset to the team. And I don't know what his communication is like. That again will improve with time. You definitely become more vocal the longer you go. And so the knock-on effect to defending with Jacob Stockdale on that side, you know, they're going to be in that Ireland team for a long time. Keith Earls would give him a huge comfort of being there, because Earls, he's an excellent defender. But he, what he does do is, sometimes as an attacker, you want to be able to, if you find an exciting opportunity in front of you, you want to be able to make a decision quickly. And what he does, he almost lures you into a sense of, I don't know what I'm going to do yet. Allow you react in some way so then I can make a decision.
Yeah.
And the longer you stay off, and then sometimes hit late, and then people make a bad decision. A great example of that was in the Scottish game with Johnny Sexton, where he was back in the backfield, and Hugh Jones chipped and regathered.
It's two on
and
one.
He stood and a two on one, and he stood off him, and then he hit late, and Hugh Jones was relaxed, waiting for that moment to arrive, where he was able to simply put Stuart Hogg away. Mm. But that time, all of a sudden, he thought was a plenty, got slammed closed.
It's funny, that principle applies to so many sports. I mean, you will often hear a striker running in on goal against a goalkeeper. They want the keeper to make up their mind for them. And sometimes the keeper puts the onus back on them, and they're out of time, and it's over.
And those hundredths of a second become thousandths of a second decision then.
The other interesting, the overall kind of striking point I took from the weekend was, in 2009, it felt like the summit. It felt like this generation, you don't want to say deserved it, but deserved it and got it. And it felt like, whoa, we've done it. And with the greatest respect, 2018 feels to this team like, this is not necessarily the summit. This is a really big, nice stepping stone in part of some big journey over the next 18 months. Who knows how it ends, but this isn't it. Like, this isn't us kind of going, we've done it territory. It doesn't feel like that.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to say that this was a box-ticking exercise, because many of the internationals that played had never won. Well, nearly everyone except for Rob Kearney and
Best
had never won a Grand Slam. So it's a big deal, considering we've only won three now in our history. So you don't want to gloss over that quickly, but you do get the sense that this is ultimately a stepping stone to something great, to something big in Japan next year. And I heard Rob Kearney make reference to that.
Just going to say, put it this way, when you were doing your interviews in 09 on the pitch in Cardiff, it was about the moment.
Oh, 100%.
It was noticeable that Rob Kearney, enjoying the moment, did also put the win into the context of the next 18 months. Now, I appreciate he's maybe older, and maybe the younger guys were going, well, hey, but in 09, there was no one even, the World Cup's...
We did not give it a thought. Yeah. We did not give it a thought. So that makes you think that this has been talked about as part of the bigger plan.
Yeah.
That this is an aspect en route to doing something special, and not just getting to a semi-final. I know we're not in the greatest place in the world to be able to be excessively confident about World Cups off the back of where we've been, but you do feel as though this isn't a team that wants to go and do something no other Irish team has done before and get to a semi-final. These want to get to a final, and they want to win a World Cup. Mm. And
well, if you're number two in the world,
well, you've got a chance, right? You'd have to think you've got a chance. And also the fact that the best team in the world, the double World Cup holders from 2011 and 15, have been beaten in the last 18 months or 2 years, 18 months. So it's not that unthinkable thought of, gosh, if you came across the All Blacks in a World Cup in some capacity, how would you deal with it? I think there is a confidence. I definitely don't think it's an arrogance. I think it's a confidence that is breeding through this team that, you know what, if we stay the course and do what we can, what we have been doing, that we have a great chance. The reality is, we still need a lot of luck. We got luck against France to win this slam. You need luck.
And you need luck. You don't want Conor Murray getting injured. You don't want Johnny Sexton. There's a few irreplaceables, I presume. 11 of the 23 just on Saturday are 26 years old or under. I wanted to ask, like, it still all feels like it revolves around Schmidt in many respects. Like, is this another potential, it's a terrible tag, I know, but is it like a golden generation of players coming through, the likes of Ryan, Levy, all of these different players coming through? Or is Joe Schmidt making very, very, very good players kind of look exceptional, Grand Slam winners, number two in the world? Will they be challenging for Grand Slams now, this group of players, almost regardless of the coach?
I think we'll only really understand that when Joe decides to exit, be it after the World Cup in 2019. Maybe he'll sign again. Who knows with that? But you do get a sense that he has an absolutely enormous part to play in bringing this caliber of player through. He's clearly realised the errors of his way of not having the squad that he needed in 2015 to get beyond the quarterfinal, the over-reliance on key individuals. But You would think if the World Cup was coming in September, it would be the first time that you would look and realize that you'd have three or four or five guys that wouldn't make the squad that we'd be shocked about. Yeah. That we'd think, gosh, that is so unlucky that he's a player and yet there's no space for it. Usually it's a Sivi Vaatu or someone for the All Blacks. You go, wow, really? Mm. How's he not in? But I genuinely think that we will feel that, provided we've got close to a full deck to choose from.
Yeah, it's remarkable he's achieved, 3 and 5 years in this Grand Slam while still manoeuvring the squad and manipulating the squad and building the squad.
Yeah, and you know what? And I think it's worth mentioning too. And you talk about the adaptability of the squad. I think it's a special mention. I was very, very impressed with Kieran Marmion when he came on. You know, he's twice come on onto the wing, once against Australia last year or maybe two years ago,
I think, yeah.
And made some brilliant defensive reads. And he came on, I thought he did a fantastic job as well. And that's a big ask against England in a Grand Slam game to play out of position, but he looks very comfortable there. It is a case, he knows that he's probably wing cover as well, so he's got two roles to look after. He's not going to come on in any other position, but there's a chance, you know, if we have a couple of injuries, that he's going to have to look after wing too. And I thought he did a great job for the only 7 or 8 minutes that he was on, but he was defending with Larmer, who got a little bit narrow a couple of times, but he allowed him time to get out to him and hedged his bets very well, looked very smart and comfortable there. Didn't look as though he was a scrum half playing out on the wing.
Considering Larmer's stated aim at the start of the year was to play a few Leinster A games, we'll allow him to get a bit narrow.
Do you know what? He's box office going forward, and it will take time, and people have to be patient with that. And I'm not scrutinising. It's never good to scrutinise when there's been success, but he'll know himself. He'll look at the video, and there's a new combination there of Joey Carberry, Gary Ringrose and Jordan Larmer that probably have never defended together, even at training, or very, very rarely. Yeah. And, you know, he plays full back for Leinster, by the way, and played on the wing in his first cap, and now he's thrown into the centre in Twickenham. So it will come. He's a smart footballer. But, yeah, you know, what I like about him too is, you know, he plays narrow, but he also thinks in his head, I'm so fast, I think I'm going to be able to get out here. And he nearly solves a problem every time in doing so. Imagine how good a defender he'll be when he actually gets brilliant spacing.
One last point then. I saw the Opta statistics people released there. I mean, this is a real lies and statistics kind of a question, I know, but their Opta team of the tournament, based on, they look back video wise at every pass, every moment on the ball, somehow taught up its importance and all the various other statistics. So there were only 4 Irish players on the team of the tournament. Connor Murray, who also was their player of the tournament. So
right, I get that.
Given that. Tadhg Furlong, again, CJ Stander and Jacob Stockdale. Tomasso Allan was their number 10.
Right.
Interesting, but I mean, I didn't dig down into the stats. Who were your standout players then, with just your eye away from the stats for Ireland? Is it Murray by a distance?
It's Murray. It's Murray, and you see, Jacob Stockdale's been excellent. But I think if you're looking over the courses of everything, take the try scoring out of it. Fantastic going forward. Take that, but that is a component.
Take the seven
tries away from the debut season of the 21-year-old.
Yeah,
I thought the defensive efforts over the course of the tournament from Keith Earls were exceptionally good. He didn't get Did he score a try? Maybe. I'm not even sure how many.
Did he score against Italy? Do you know, funny, my main memory of the Italy game is him sprinting back at the very end.
So,
but
it's his defence at the weekend. And maybe I sometimes get a little bit hung up on defensive efforts, but defences do win games. Yes, you need to score 7 tries as well to win tournaments. So I don't want to take away from that phenomenal performance, but I thought Keith Earls was really excellent. Yeah. I think Conor Murray, I think Levy had a really great tournament as well. Mm. Henderson was excellent when he came in. It's very, very hard to...
It's a good drop goal in Paris as well.
it was a pretty reasonable drop goal from Johnny Sexton too. So it's
maybe that's it is.
I think Murray's the standout. Okay. I think he is the standout. Sorry, notable mention for Rob Kearney, Bundiaki as well. These guys have all performed pretty well, but I do think on the whole, if I was looking at a player of the Six Nations, I think the overall intelligence and understanding and manipulation of a game by Conor Murray, both defensively and in attack, he's been outstanding for 3 years, really good before that, but really outstanding. And for me, I think he's a shoe-in for a World Player of the Year nomination at this moment in time. Right. If there was one tomorrow, he is way further on than in the conversation.
Okay. That is us done with the rugby. There's obviously a June tour of Australia to come, the All Blacks in November, and then England first up in the Six Nations in Dublin next year. So that's all ahead. My thanks to Brian O'Driscoll. We'll take a short break.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.